You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right. So let's define our terms. He says in verse 1, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it, the men of old gained approval. So there are three key words here that are defining what this faith is all about. He says, first, faith is assurance. Assurance. That is that kind of inner awareness that I've thought it through, it makes sense, and I'm prepared to proceed. Assured of things hoped for, he says. Namely, that God has made promises and that I have reason to believe that God is faithful to those promises. And so that's where that assurance comes from. It's not because I just really, really, really want to believe and therefore it becomes true for me, but rather I understand what God has promised to do for me and am convinced by the evidence that he has been true to those promises and that they have occurred in reality. That's really what the letter of Hebrews is there to demonstrate, that God promised that there would be a Messiah that would come, that would offer himself as a sacrifice for the failings, the sin, the brokenness of humanity. And then he calls upon us to receive the forgiveness that death freely purchased for us. And that's where the assurance comes from. It's that we don't add anything to the mix. It's what God has totally done for us, and it's the finished work. That's the argument of Hebrews. And if we understand that argument, and we're prepared to say, okay, I'm ready for that. That is the message that I need to hear. Then what does it mean? It means to take that step of assurance based upon the promises of God to say yes to him. And then beyond that, he says, too, the conviction of things not seen. And now we're moving from an assurance that is based upon data, which is based upon our understanding of the confirmation of this promise, to something that's a little deeper, a little bit closer to the heart, perhaps. And the idea of conviction is that we are prepared to trust, that we are willing to bet our lives on what is being said. And I think that there's something important for us to realize here. Yeah, there is a call to believe, a call to root your convictions, the what are you about, the who are you about, on these claims and these promises that the author of Hebrews lays out for us. But let's also be quick to note that everyone is a believer. Everyone is driven by a set of convictions. Sometimes we're not even aware of what those convictions are, but we are all driven by them. We all have a basic set of assumptions that we root our life in and that are a guide for us and help us to understand what's important and what way to go and what way not to go. Everyone in that sense is a believer and is following their convictions. Years ago, when I was a teacher in the humanities department at Columbus State, we had philosophy classes I would teach, and students would come in and I would say, you know, well, how come you're in my class? And the honest ones would say, well, I'm here because I have to fulfill a humanities requirement. Okay, fair enough. Well, why do you need a humanities requirement? Well, they would say, of course, to get my degree so that I can go on from here to Ohio State or wherever I'm going. Fair enough. Why do you need a degree? And they would look a little puzzled, and they'd say, well, to get a job, of course, right? And I'd say, well, great, but why do you need a job? And they'd say, well, to make money, right? Okay, but why do you need to make money? Well, in this world, it takes money to buy things. I'm like, cool, okay, but why do you need to buy things? And I'd be like, to be happy, of course. I say, oh, now I understand. You're in my class because you want to be happy. See, everyone when you think about it and you peel the layers back, is driven in the decisions that they make in everyday life by some set of assumptions. And the set of assumptions of my students was that if they make enough money, that will make them happy. I'm not so sure about that assumption, but it's there nonetheless. What about this conviction? This conviction that God has come into the world through Christ and is offering you the opportunity, the to be reconciled to him. That's what the claim is here. And then he says, for by it, by this faith, the people of old gained approval. And this has always been the standard, the conditions upon which people engage with God. Genesis 15, verse 6. Abraham believed God, and God counted to him as righteousness. He's not saying, you need to present your credentials to me. Show me that you deserve it, whatever. Or meet you halfway. Show me that you're better, more good than bad. None of that is in the biblical frame. The way that we receive approval from God is simply by believing in what he has promised us and for nothing else, just that. So if you're here tonight and you're thinking about this whole Christianity thing and what's at stake for you and what does it mean to get involved with this, let's just make it clear from the outset with the author of Hebrews. It costs you nothing. You simply receive what you cannot earn and take that in and become a child of God. That's the condition. And now having understood then the basic summary of what this letter is about, let's now apply, as our author does, this idea of faith in terms of how do we live this thing out in everyday life. And I've chosen of the many examples in Hebrews 11 to focus on Moses. And every description of Moses' faith, along with all the other characters that are covered in this chapter, begin by the expression, by faith. And so five times, we'll see in our discussion here this evening, five facets of Moses' faith. And I think each of these five just directly speak to our own experience in ways that I think will become somewhat evident. But he says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So now let's take a step back because we need to provide some context. Who is this Moses and what's going on? And so the background here is that Moses' faith emerges from the historic conditions of the people of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, who had received this promise of a promised land, Canaan, or modern-day Israel, but that they were living in Egypt, where they had gone centuries before because of famine that existed in the land. And they had prospered, they'd become not just a family, but now a mighty nation of hundreds of thousands of people. And so much so that at a certain point, the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, decided there are so many of these Hebrews that they actually constitute a threat to our power. And so as a result, they were enslaved. And so then things really become difficult then for the people of God. They become slaves, but even more it says the king's edict is the immediate background to our story. The king's edict was, look, the only way to control this population is by executing the male children that are born to the Hebrews. And so that's the introduction in Exodus chapter 1, this policy that is not just controversial, but is outright, you know, just ignored by the midwives of this era, and it's creating this very incredible, unstable social environment in Egypt, out of which this story emerges. And the first thing that we want to point to, and is evident in this paragraph, is the background to Moses, which is namely his parents. And so I think that that's actually kind of an important place to start. I love biographies. I don't know if you're readers, and if you're readers, that if you like biography. I read several biographies a year. I just find them fascinating. I find people's the unique struggles that people face and how they overcome them and how they put the pieces of their life together. So fascinating. And then those same people go on to accomplish things that really matter. There's a lot to be learned there. But in all cases, it seems, biographers start not with the central focus of their study, but rather with their family, with their parents, with their backgrounds. And the point is that the things that we appreciate often most about our own lives are things that are given to us. by our upbringing, by the influence of people outside of ourselves who have shown us the way, who have provided for us in various ways that we could not have done for ourselves. And so it is with Moses. The story of Moses begins with his parents who, it says, were not afraid of the king's edict. So the call is that every son is to be eliminated, and they're like, yeah, no. And so their response, their faith response, was to directly counter what Pharaoh was offering with a plan. Here's the plan. So Pharaoh wants all male children executed. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to build a basket that has tar on it and so it can float. And a few months into it, we're going to take our newborn baby boy and we're going to put him in the basket and we're going to send him down the Nile River to the place that we know Pharaoh, his household, his daughter especially, is out bathing. And so this person who has ordered the execution of all babies such as this will no doubt find a place in his household for him. Yeah. That sounds crazy. Except that there's no real plan B. Right? And so that's the plan. And as it is hatched, we're told that the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister, that is the child's sister, said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I'll give you wages." And so the woman took the child and nursed him, and the child grew up. As the child grew, she brought him back to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses because, she says, "I drew him from the water." So actually what happens is this child who was marked for execution, because of the careful planning of Moses' parents and the help of his older sister, actually brought this baby to the direct personal attention of the very decision-making family on whose base this child's life would depend. And she had sort of the compassion response that a person will sometimes have when in the abstract we can make a decision about policy, and then when we see the person face to face in real terms, then we realize what's really at stake. And so this young woman, this daughter of Pharaoh, decides, yes, I'll have compassion on this child. I'll raise him as my own. And so, the plan works. And the point here about faith is that we must be prepared to trust God with our children, even in the face of uncertainty. And I think that's really important for so many of us here this morning who are starting families. We've got little kids, and we are really concerned about the development of those kids, as we should be. But are we also prepared to recognize that at the end of the day, these children are God's children, and that He has a stake in their life, and that the real important thing here for us to consider is not what is my plan for my child, but how can I put my child in that place where they understand as much as they can understand and need to understand to make decisions about their own spiritual life that will carry them on into adulthood. Because at the end of the day, they're God's children, and as such, our job is to prepare them for what God has for them in their life. And I just think that that's an important thing just for us to keep in mind, to remember, so that maybe it would take a little bit of the anxiety and the fuss out of what parents like myself, for sure, and my wife, when our children were quite young, had about our kids. The worry that we were going to, you know, do something wrong and it was going to permanently mark them or whatever, just to realize, you know, kids are really pretty resilient And what really matters is that I'm regularly and consciously putting this child before the Lord, saying, he's yours. And help me be that kind of an influence as a parent in this child's life, that they can truly understand you and truly understand the fruit of what it means to follow you. That's what parenting is about. And Moses was the beneficiary of this kind of parenting, as are so many of us. And if it's not parents, it's other people in our life who similarly had this outlook that God's got something important for you. And so they were willing to move towards you and care about you and make the claims of Christ real and compelling to you. And that's how it works. No one is made in a vacuum. We're a part of the fabric of God's people, and we find the resources that we need to make those faith decisions within that context. It says, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Now, this is an important second move then. Now we've got Moses who's grown up, and now he's beginning to think about the influences that he had earlier in his life. He's looking at the world of his experience, and it says that he had grown up as Pharaoh's daughter. And specifically, what does that mean? It means that he's living in the palace, and we're told in Acts 7, verse 22, that Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians and was a man of power in word and deed. And so it is that in the court of the Egyptian Pharaoh are the resources of the ancient Near Eastern world, the wisdom of the Babylonians, the Hittites, other empires would come together, and in these courts, real education would be taking place. The historian James Hoffmeyer, in his book Israel in Egypt, writes, he says, in Thutmose III initiated the practice of bringing the princes of subject kings of Western Asia to Egypt to be trained in Egyptian ways. Foreign princes were no strangers to the Egyptian court under Pharaoh Hattusit, and the dates are insignificant here, 1479 to 1457 BC, because that comes right on the tails of Moses himself. A Semite named Aparel served as his vizier. So this is a well-known practice, and we can imagine easily Moses growing up, as Stephen says in this speech in Acts chapter 7, with all of the resources of learning that made the Egyptian empire a great empire in law, in art, in science, in mathematics, in all of these things. And so here is a man, Moses, who has all of the advantages of being a part of Pharaoh's own family. And yet it says that he refused to be called Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And so here, Moses finds himself at the crossroads of life. He knows that he's a Hebrew. He is the son of slaves, and yet living in this incredible place of privilege in the household of Pharaoh. And so there is this need to say yes and to say no, to make a choice. Who am I? What will be the trajectory of my life? What will I be all about? And so that really is, there are moments in our life where we need to be able to say no to one thing so that we can say yes to something else. And those decisions are going to have an enormous impact on defining what our life really is all about, what it stands for, what we accomplish. And they're binary. Yes or no. For years, my wife and I bought a house on campus in the late 80s for $47,000. And it was 100 years old, and it was trashed, but we loved it. And we put it back together, But we realized it's impossible for us to raise our children where this house was located. And so we sold it and moved. And for years, we would look back at that house and think, you know, oh, if there's just some way we could have made it work. But no, we couldn't make it work. And life is full of decisions like that. And so he says in verse 26 that Moses considered the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking, he says, to the reward. And so there is that need to look at our lives and the important decisions that we are going to make in life, considering this broader picture, looking toward this reward, looking at the promises of God, and are they real? And am I willing to put the weight of my life behind those promises? And so who we marry, where we live, what we do with our 9-to-5, there are just many, many decisions that we make in life that just determine the course of where life will go. And I'm just reminded here that Moses calls us to consider, to think it through, to make a decision that matches the convictions that we really are all about, to make those convictions real and life-changing. And sometimes that's really hard. Many years ago, I'd worked very hard to get through undergraduate school, to get through graduate school. And in 1985, having finished my graduate work, I had an opportunity to start teaching. And in my field, in philosophy, those jobs are not easy to get. And over the course of the next 2 years, cobbled together a network of teaching positions that enabled me essentially to work full-time and to make my money by teaching, and it was something I deeply loved. And our first child was born, and my wife and I really began to think about, okay, how do we prioritize our family, this passion that you have to teach and to do your work, in terms of where we live and so forth. And at that time, we were living in Chicago. And we thought about that a lot. And for months, just were interacting, praying, thinking this thing through. And came to the conclusion that really what is most important is our family. And that means raising our children in a community that we trust, that is going to have the sort of influence on them that extends our vision for our children, to be in a place where we can develop broader skills to serve God together. And so we decided, after a couple of years of working and living in this way, to just pack up our bags and with $1,000 we had to our name, move back to No Job Columbus. And it was super scary. Because of the responsibilities that weigh on a person with a family like that. And so what can I say? What I can say is it was the best decision we ever made. It was awesome. God provided more than abundantly all that we needed, and that career that meant so much to me that I had left actually picked right up within a matter of months when I was offered a tenure-track position at Columbus State to teach there. And so just taking that risk, making a decision that we're going to put what matters most first, even though there is cost involved, that we live in an either-or, not both-and world in important matters, that God is faithful. And that was just such a profoundly important lesson for us. And so Moses makes this either-or decision. He says, I'm going to stand with my slave population people, not with the privilege of the palace. And so we move on then to the next verse, and it says, by faith, thirdly, he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who was unseen. And so here, this component of faith in the unseen God. Let's get a bit of the story here. He says he left Egypt. Well, he fled Egypt, actually. What happened was, once having made that decision to stand with his people, his conscience became sensitized to their dire situation and the exploitation of the Egyptian people toward his Hebrew brothers and sisters. And so seeing a guard abuse one of the Hebrew slaves, Moses rose up and struck him, and struck him a little too hard and killed him. And so now Moses has to really think about, what am I now? I'm not just an advocate for my people, I'm also a criminal at this point. And we are told, again in Acts chapter 7, a commentary on this passage, that Moses supposed that his fellow Israelites understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they didn't understand. They weren't ready for Moses. They weren't ready for deliverance. They weren't ready to take a stand against the Egyptians. They didn't have the resources. They didn't have even the sense of possibility that there's anything that could be done. And Moses, on his part, was not ready to do it God's way. He's going to take matters into his own hands. He's going to launch a rebellion, a slave revolt, and people are going to take over that way. And that's just not going to happen. And it becomes really apparent immediately after this event when Moses' own people reject him and say, you know, who are you anyway? And so he realizes this is not happening. And so he flees. He leaves to the desert. So Green Acres is a story of a rich Manhattan lawyer who gets tired of being a lawyer and goes back to the farm, only to be a complete doofus because he has no knowledge of farming. He doesn't know what he's doing. Similarly, Moses flees to the desert, marries a woman, and becomes a shepherd. And the 40 years is interesting. It's fully a third of his life. And 40 years always kind of represents, you know, there's 40 years in the wilderness. Jesus goes 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness. It's always represented as a time of testing. And so it is with this revolutionary, this guy Moses. He's rejected by his people. God somehow seems very distant. And here he is out in the middle of nowhere with nothing to do but tend a sheep, which is exactly where God wanted him to be. Because why? Because there are certain lessons that only sheep can teach. Sheep aren't bright. People are not bright. They don't know what they're into. And Moses needs to understand that. If you're going to be a leader, you got to understand those whom you lead. And so go out there and learn the limitations of sheep and the parallel to human beings. Sheep know how to stray off and get themselves into a lot of trouble. And so you're going to have to learn to set aside your agenda to go out and seek those that are in this danger. Sheep are also cuddly and require the milk of human kindness. Now, none of these things were native to a guy like Moses, who was a take charge, make it happen kind of guy. But if he's going to be God's guy, some things fundamental about who he is are going to need to change. And so the life of faith involves not relying on my resources, my abilities, my skills, but learning instead to look at life the way that God does and to look at our calling through his eyes. He is our great shepherd. He's the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. And anyone who would represent him or do work for him is going to have to learn these lessons that only sacrifice and sweat and care and toil can actually teach us. And so there he is, learning those lessons. And it says, seeing him who is unseen. And so for nearly 40 years, Moses is working away at this project that God had for him under the tutelage of his father-in-law, to have his character honed and shaped, his way of looking at things revised significantly. And at the end of these 40 years, The unseen God appears to him. And we read in Exodus chapter 3, he said to the burning bush, and the voice that came through it, it says, "Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground." And so he said, "I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look. And so after this time, then God, in this most unlikely way, reveals himself to Moses, and he says to him, "I have not forgotten my promise to your forefathers. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And then he calls him to return to Egypt, to be that newly shaped and formed leader that God had made him to be, to lead his people out. And that is a kind of a sweet little picture here of what God does. He comes to us when we are ready to hear, when we are ready to see. He's prepared to reveal, and then calls on us to seek and to find. Jesus says, "Knock and the door will be opened unto you." That's right. When we're ready to hear and to be a real seeker, then God calls on us to respond to those things that we do know, the questions that keep plaguing our soul that we can't answer, but we know are important. Why does my life matter at all? Why am I here? What is the life that God would have for me that would mean something that mattered? And when we're in that mode, when we finally put aside our agenda, our pursuits, just to quiet ourselves before God. And in the case of a guy like Moses, it took a long time to get to that place. Hopefully we're a little bit quicker learners. Then, when we knock on that door, we're prepared to hear, and God will speak. And I just think that that's really a super important kind of piece of this story. But the burning bush doesn't come at the beginning of the story for Moses. It comes really at that crucial point where he has really kind of lost all sense of his own self-importance, the role that he's going to play as this great deliverer and so forth. And when he's prepared then to set that aside, now he can hear from God. We're going to talk next time about the discipline of the Lord from chapter 12, and it really segues off of this process that we're seeing Moses experience out in the wilderness, this time of testing. But let's move on, because it says, by faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. So now Moses has gone back to Egypt with his brother Aaron. And they're going to confront the Pharaoh, and they're going to say, "Let my people go." And he's going to say, "No." And they're going to say, "Why?" And he's going to say, "Because." And they're going to say, "Okay. Then sounds like what you need to see is God." And so there is a series of 9 plagues that God works through Moses that really address all of the aspects of Egypt's social life and the gods that they worshipped, to show that these Hebrews, these slave peoples, have a God who transcends nature, who is greater than their gods, and calls on them to let my people go. And Moses just steadfastly keeps on refusing until we come to the 10th and final plague, which is called the Passover. And the Passover's instructions were this, that the angel of death will come over the land, and the firstborn son of every family and of every animal, it will die, unless a substitute for the death of that individual is provided. A lamb is to be taken, an unblemished lamb, at a certain number of months of age, to be slaughtered, and where the blood then is on over the door and on its sides. So that, again, in this symbolic way, the angel of death passes over the house, sees the blood on the door, and it recognizes, therefore, that a sacrifice has been made for that individual in that family who was subject to death. And this was such an important event because why? Because the Egyptians believed that their Pharaoh was the primary god, Ra, and that his son would accede to his throne and also become the incarnation of the sun god Ra. And so, in the refusal of Pharaoh to obey the terms of the Passover, his own son dies, his inheritance dies. And so Moses then is told, okay, what's going to happen then is we're going to have this meal, this Passover feast. It's going to represent this time that we've had in slavery, and it is preparation for us to pack our bags and go immediately out of the country. And so this is, becomes this whole window then into the price of the most central event of the Bible, which is the ransom price for freedom. And so we're having a description here of what does salvation mean. It means being freed from our bondage to our own fallen nature, the penalty that is due us as a rebel against God. And so we are not free. We are very much in bondage to our condition and the sentence that comes with that. And there is nothing we can do to change that. And the Bible declares what we cannot do, God has done. And the Passover is just a big symbolic framework for us to understand the words of Paul as he says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 5 and 6, there is one God and one mediator also between God and men, the man, Christ Jesus, who gave himself as a ransom for all. And you know, he's given himself as a ransom for you tonight. He's paid the debt that you owe. The jail cell door is open. He's just asking you to respond in faith to that freedom, that forgiveness that he has offered you in the ransom of his own blood. That's what this is all about. And God told Moses, he says, this event, this Passover, is the first day of the year for you. This is the thing that defines who I am in relation to my people. I am your deliverer, your redeemer, as it's called. I am the one who pays the ransom for your freedom. And then we move on in verse 29, where he says, by faith they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. And so here we come to our last component of faith, which is victory. So the Passover is celebrated. Pharaoh's son is dead. In his anger and his anguish, Pharaoh demands that the people go, only long enough to come to his senses and realize, what have I done? I've let my slave population go. And so he brings his army together and says, it's time to get it on, get down there, and to realize they're going south, which is crazy because we're going to catch up to them in no time. We're going to slaughter them on the plain. Nobody pulls one over on the Pharaoh. And so there it is. That's the situation. But there's a victory that God has planned for his people that are the first fruits of the things that they hope for. Here's a real experience of the reality of this freedom that God is bringing to his people. So they go down along the Red Sea coast, and they see Pharaoh's army gaining ground and coming upon them, and they cry out to God. It's like, okay, so you just let us out here to die? And God's like, no, it's not that way at all. Instead, you're going to experience something that you have never conceived before as you act on what I show you. And here's what he shows him. In Exodus chapter 14, verse 13, Moses said to the people, don't fear. There's a lot of reason to fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. And the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. To Moses, he says, lift up your staff and stretch your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go through in the midst of the sea on dry land. And so here is this incredible, miraculous moment where Pharaoh's army is coming down upon them, and God, through Moses, has now parted the waters of the Red Sea for the people to go through. And it's like, wow, what would be worse? Being slaughtered on the plain by Pharaoh's army or going out into the water to be drowned in the Red Sea? But they believe. They are willing to test the waters, as it were. They're willing to take that step. And as they take that step, then they are beginning to realize the ground is reliable. We can walk. And so they begin to walk, and they walk through on the other side. And as the last of them come across the other side of the Red Sea, the waves come crashing down, and Pharaoh's army is destroyed. And so they are able to experience in real time that if we are prepared to act on the promises of God, we will experience the first fruits, the beginning of the reality of all that God has for us. And that is super cool, super sweet. Here's a question. How will you know that grace unless you risk being rejected? Think about that. You know, we've got stuff going on in our lives. We've got relationships where, you know, I've been wrong, sure, but I've certainly done my share of being in the wrong. And what we really want is peace, but we realize to get to peace in that relationship, there are things I've got to own about that relationship and my failure there. Capiche? Yeah. We're all at fault in fundamental ways, and the reason why our relationships are broken is because of the log in our own eye. And how is that ever going to change? How are we ever going to experience forgiveness and all of the reconciliation that comes with that unless we are willing to take that step of faith to confess our wrong and then to be able to experience the forgiveness of the person that we've wronged? That's a life-changing experience. That's what heals broken marriages. That's what brings together generations of strife within a family. That's what enables people who have been competitors and who are bitter toward one another to come and resolve their differences so that they can be allies together. And that's all promised to us, but I'm sure that you're like me. In the sense that you know that that's the pathway forward, and yet there's something, everything perhaps within you that says, I'm not opening my mouth. I will not admit it. That person should admit it, but not me. Not me first, to be sure. And for that reason, then, nothing changes. Things just begin to continue to disintegrate. And you will never experience the life-changing grace of God in that personal way until we're prepared to acknowledge our fault, risk the potential rejection in relationship so that we can experience the real forgiveness that comes freely to us from the people of God who have been forgiven for their sin and therefore are freely prepared to give it to us. But there's a risk, isn't there? You've got to step out before you experience it. Similarly, how do you know God is faithful to his word without trusting him, without taking that step? He says, I'll never leave you, nor will I ever forsake you. That whatever situation that you're in, I'm bigger than that situation. Will you take the moment to trust me in that situation and in all of your fears and risk your heart's vulnerability by saying, God, I do trust you. Show me what it looks like for me to take that step of faith to follow you, even in my anger, my pain, my distress, my confusion, whatever it is. And when we do that, then the thing becomes clearer to us. We're able to see even indeed the hand of God in the context of very difficult things in our life. How do you know Self-giving love is uniquely satisfying unless you serve those who can't repay. Jesus says it's more blessed to give than to receive. How do you know that? In a world that's out for itself, out for number one, how do we know that the more blessed path, the more fulfilling path, the more life-giving path is actually in giving yourself away? Well, there's just only one way that you'll know that. It's if you take that step and you empty yourself for the sake of another. So this is the framework of faith that our author of Hebrews brings to us through the story of Moses. I just love it. Each of these five aspects of faith, I think, are very much worth our reflection. Let's pray together. Thank you, Lord, that you call us to a faith that is victorious, that changes our lives, but is rooted in real substance on the basis of what you've done. And so we just thank you that we can come to you with empty hands and an open heart to say, please have your way with us. Please let your atoning sacrifice, your death, count for my failures, my guilt, so that I can be alive to you. I can have this kind of relationship, this kind of faith odyssey that ultimately will result in a total victory, that new person that you intend for us to be. Thank you for this group. Thank you that we are of one mind, really, here about our desire to see you lifted up and recognized and responded to by our world as we respond in faith to you. So thank you for these things in Christ's name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.